You're listening to World Class from the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University. We bring expertise on international affairs from Stanford's campus straight to you. I'm Catherine Stoner, the Deputy Director of the Freeman Spogli Institute and a Senior Fellow. Today it's my pleasure to introduce Michael McFaul, who is the Director of the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford. He's also Professor of Political Science, the former United States Ambassador to Russia from 2012 to 2014, and a Montanan. He is also, of course, the host of World Class. However, today on
Roll
the show,
reversals today, huh?
We're going to turn things around. Mike is here as a guest, and we're going to talk all about his new book out May 8th, 2018, From Cold War to Hot Peace, An American Ambassador in Putin's Russia. Welcome, Mike, as a guest to your own show.
Well, thanks for having me.
So congratulations first on the book's publication and the terrific reception that it's receiving. I know you've been away a lot on a book tour, actually leaving me in charge of the Freeman Spogli Institute.
I hope things are well in order here at FSI.
There's been a bit of a revolution, but we'll tell you about that later.
A little bit later, all right.
But I know that you've also answered lots of questions about your experiences as ambassador and as described in the book. But the book is more than just that period from 2012 to 2014. It's really also a personal history of your engagement with the Soviet Union and then Russia as its successor state, as first a scholar and then eventually an activist and then ultimately a policymaker and ambassador. It really starts out as a love story between you and this fantastically interesting part of the world. And then it really ends in tragedy, since your policy work got you banned in Russia as of 2016 through the present period. So can you talk a bit about how the story started? You were a boy from Montana who had never been abroad before 1983 and your first trip there. How did you get interested in the Soviet Union initially?
Well, initially it was in Montana. I moved from Butte to Bozeman, which are two B towns for most people in Montana they'd never heard of, but they're pretty different places. And Bozeman is the town where Montana State University is. I was looking for an easy A. Because I was not that interested in writing back then for an easy A in English.
That's ironic.
Yeah, it is ironic. I really wasn't. I didn't do much reading back then either, by the way. And my neighbor told me, take debate class. Debate class is the easiest A you can get in English. So I signed up for debate class, later joined the debate team as a result of that. And the topic that year was how to improve U.S. trade policy around the world. And my debate partner and I ran a squirrely case, which means a pretty obscure one, to repeal the Jackson-Vanik Amendment to the 1974 Trade Act as a way to increase trade to the Soviet Union. That that amendment tied most favored nation status to the Soviet Union to Jewish immigration.
And I'm just old enough to remember that, actually.
Well, that's a long time ago. By the way, 30 years later, I was part of the team that actually finally repealed Jackson-Vanik. But that's what sparked my interest and thinking about the relationship and then between our two countries. And I was pretty alarmed, especially after Ronald Reagan was elected president. He had some pretty provocative language about the evil empire and stirring up. It seemed like things were getting more tense. And so when I arrived here on campus, we're actually sitting in the basement of the former political science building, just so you know. So when I arrived here as a freshman, 17-year-old kid from Montana, I took two courses that really changed the arc of my career. One, first-year Russian. And two, poli sci 35.
So you even took first-year Russian that very first fall.
Fall quarter of my freshman year.
Smitten already.
Well, I wasn't smitten. I was more like – it was more about politics. I had a theory. I had a theory that if we could just get to know these people better, we could reduce tensions. So I wasn't interested in Russian culture, history, all those other things. That was not me. This was about geopolitics from the very beginning. And that was my motivation for doing that. And then 2 years later, as you just said, I took my first trip abroad to Leningrad.
Very gutsy. Right.
Imagine what my mother in Montana thought about that.
Yeah, I can really only imagine. So did you have particular mentors here at Stanford then that encouraged this interest or who knew enough about the Soviet Union who'd push you further along this way?
I did. two gentlemen that later were my thesis advisors. One was a historian, Alexander Dahlin, who I took a course with at some point, and he really nurtured my interest in Russia. I mean, he knew Russia and the Soviet Union, you know, intimately. And then another professor, Alexander George, in the Department of Political Science. I took a class on U.S.-Soviet crisis management with him at somewhere along the way. And those two guys, more than any professors here, really pushed me, you know, to make me think about these things systematically.
Mm-hmm. That's great. It's amazing how much mentors make a difference.
I think.
Yep.
Yes.
You
know, Mr. Adams, back my high school debate teacher, he was the guy. Back then, you know, I was kind of a jock, as you know, Catherine. I'm a big jock. You know, I was a. In ninth grade, I didn't lose a race either in cross country or the 2 mile. Maybe you don't know that.
Actually, maybe. I know that you've since lost some to me, but then you were fast, I gather.
You know, I was just focused on my being at my athletic career. And he was a guy, I remember one day after one debate tournament, and we were pretty good, by the way. My partner is now the senator from Montana, Steve Gaines.
Yeah, that's cool.
And he said, isn't it cool, McFall? He always called me McFall, to use your brain instead of your body to compete.
Mm-hmm.
And so those three gentlemen, put them all together, they really shaped what I've been doing roughly ever since.
America thanks Mr. Adams for both you and the senator then. So can you talk about those first few trips to, as it then was, the Soviet Union?
Yeah.
And then I want to jump into the academia to activist divide too.
Well, my first trip, summer of 1983, Leningrad, White Nights, first trip abroad. I got to tell you, honestly, I came back thinking that we were a little bit too up in arms about the Soviet Union. They weren't 8 foot, superhuman people. They look kind of poor, actually. It's like, why are we afraid of them? People were friendly, although I then later learned why they were friendly, because they were like black marketeers and stuff. I was there with a group of 100 other American students, so it was fun. It was interesting, and just being abroad for the first time. So I came back kind of pushing back on the theory that this Cold War was, you know, why were we in such up in arms about this country? I go back the winter of my senior year, 1985, to Moscow. The Pushkin Institute is where I studied. And then I had a very different experience. One, it's Moscow, harder city.
Yeah.
Two, it's January, so it's freezing. Three, the Stolovaya, the cafeteria, had to be shut down because of food poisoning. So we had to fend for ourselves to feed ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Not
that,
easy in
that 1985. That was not easy in 1985, standing in line to get food. And then fourth, more generally, my Russian was better. I got deeper into the fabric of that society. I met some dissidents. I met some refuseniks. I met some very privileged kids, too, at Moscow State University. And that's when I developed a more anti-communist mentality and pro-democracy, I would say, that we're not going to solve our relations, not going to get too close if we have these different systems. It's going to take fundamental change in that system before we become closer. But while I was there is when Mikhail Sergeyevich Gorbachev became the general secretary.
Right.
And so the last few months I was there was the beginnings of stirrings that maybe there might be change here.
Right. And then, of course, you go back later and work for the National Democratic Institute. And then open the Carnegie Moscow office. And this is after you've gone to Oxford as a Rhodes Scholar. You have a DPhil. And slowly you're transitioning from scholar to activist or scholar activist.
Yeah, I was pretty confused, if you want to know the truth, in those
but
days.
But it's actually your and I'm not just saying this because I'm your friend, but it's a pretty unique situation. I mean, no one had the network that you had as a scholar because of that work in activism. And you know, the two were symbiotic, I would say. Made your academic work really interesting, too. So How much is
some days it felt that way, some days it didn't. First time on the job market, I went zero for 22. But later in life, there were payoffs.
It panned out. Yeah,
it did. It did. That's a good point.
Yeah, I actually interviewed for the same job you have here, if you recall, right?
Yes.
Right after.
And had you gotten it, I would have gone. I would have not been in academia.
We'll see. Yay for me.
Yes. I didn't get it. I had another job at the Carnegie Endowment.
That's
and
right.
Had that not worked out, I would have gone into the think tank world. I would never be in academia.
Well, I'm glad
so
it worked out.
So I thank
out.
You. Yeah.
Yeah. So when you were an activist, I mean, obviously you were also working on the whole issue of liberalization and democratization. And then later as a policymaker, you had the same sort of opportunities to apply some of the theories of political science or what we know about political transitions.
Right.
And I know your work now, and it's in the book where you become a professor with President Obama and with people you're working with in Washington. So how easy is it to bridge that gap? Not everyone can do it. That is the gap between academia and policy work. And how difficult was that for you?
Yeah. Well, I want to start with the 90s because you raised another gap where I was trying to bridge a gap between being an academic and being an activist.
Right.
That was pretty tricky too. And there was an early time in my before I had an academic job, and that's important, 1990-91, I was living in Moscow,
right.
And that's when I did become much more of an activist, engaged with Democrats in Russia, and then came back and opened up an office for an NGO in 1992.
Right.
And I want to point out, gets confused, we weren't there meddling and doing regime change. We were there invited by the Yeltsin government. They wanted us there,
right,
because we had this similar project.
And they wanted advice. I was there around the same time, met you at the same time. We were talking to Oleg Rubyantsev, who
right.
helped write that initial constitution.
Right.
And
they wanted ideas.
Ideas
yeah.
and information.
And
right.
then that changes later once we get to the Putin era.
Right.
But back then it was different. Academia and government, also pretty hard. There's a general dismissal of academics in government. There aren't that many, by the way. There's only two or three
right.
Professors working on foreign policy when I was there. And you just have to recalibrate that certain jargon is not used. I remember I tried to use the word regression once in the White House Situation Room, and I only did that once. You know, that's not a word you use there. That said, I also felt, compared to some of my new political appointees in the Obama administration, that I had one great advantage as the Russia guy at the National Security Council.
Mm-hmm.
I really knew my subject well. A lot of people didn't know the subjects they were in charge of as well as I did.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a great advantage. I think knowing the history of Russia and knowing the language gave me a leg up. And,
mm-hmm.
and the language thing, small little footnote, part of why that was important is Obama understood that, and he wanted me in the room when he was meeting with Medvedev or Putin. He wanted me on the phone sitting in the Oval Office because I understood Russian,
right?
Because I could hear it twice. And there were some crises moments where that turned out to be really important. In fact, one of the coolest photos in the book
right.
is
the
me
desk.
Leaning yeah. over Obama, giving him some advice on a phone call. The moment was horrible because we had screwed up something. But I figured that problem out because I was listening to Medvedev, listening to his Russian.
Mm-hmm.
Even with great translators, things get lost. So
right.
it turns out that academic training and those qualitative skills, right, history,
right.
knowing the language, were useful to me as a government official.
Right, right. So I want to flip a little bit more into the book, and you talk about the importance of agency, that is individuals,
yes.
and as opposed to sort of the structure of the international
right.
system and whatnot. And you're one of the few academics who has met all four Soviet post-Soviet leaders,
right.
Gorbachev, Yeltsin, Putin, and Medvedev.
Yeah, that's true. I've met them all.
So how would you compare them?
Oh, that's a great question.
Trying to ask one you probably haven't been asked.
Yeah, nobody
on the
asked
tour.
Me that. That is definitely original. Very different, actually. Gorbachev was pretty refined. I used to see Gorbachev when I was ambassador. Right, so I've seen him for many, many years and met him first here at Stanford when he came to see George Shultz in 1988, I think it was, or 90, I think. Refined guy, very polite, diplomatic, a pretty tragic figure himself who had ideas that didn't go the way he wanted. Always interesting to talk to him. Mm-hmm. And I enjoyed seeing him, knowing what a historic figure he was when I was ambassador. Yeltsin, much gruffer, much more charismatic, somebody willing to like break a lot of things to make things happen, mm-hmm. kind of a heroic figure in that way. But also over time, and I didn't know Yeltsin well, I would observe him. I only met him once or twice. Obviously stayed in office longer than he should have, in mm-hmm. my view, because towards the end of his career, he had health problems and was not really in charge. Medvedev and Putin, I would just say Medvedev is a very educated guy, young guy, went to law school, didn't go to the KGB school, was Western oriented. Mm-hmm. I think secretly he wanted to be the next Gorbachev, but was working he didn't have the same convictions mm-hmm. or strength of his ideas or willing to carry them out. And two, he worked in a constrained environment that the prime minister was Putin. Gorbachev didn't have that.
Right.
Whereas Putin, cruder, in some ways more like Yeltsin in the way he speaks, even their language. Medvedev has a much more refined way of speaking Russian. Putin is much cruder. Mm-hmm. Arrogant, I would say, is a word I would use with Putin. He's been there for 18 years. He thinks he knows everything. Mm-hmm. Everybody around him is, not his equal, both domestically and interlocutors like Barack Obama.
Right, right. So in the book, you talk about Medvedev and Obama and you having a certain rapport, very positive rapport, there are a lot of accomplishments from the reset. What do you think the main lasting accomplishments of the reset are, given that we're in such a difficult time now with U.S.-Russian relations?
Well, very practically, we got a bunch of things done that we thought made the United States safer and better off. Mm-hmm. And that was always the goal. The goal was never better relations. The goal was concrete things. So we signed a START treaty that reduced by 30% the number of nuclear weapons allowed between the United States and Russia. That's a big deal. That's a good deal. We put in place sanctions on Iran, most comprehensive sanctions ever. That got us the Iran nuclear deal.
Right.
Tragically, our president has moved away from it, but I think it's going to last beyond Trump, by the mm-hmm. way. We opened up a supply route to Afghanistan that reduced our dependency on Pakistan dramatically from like 95% to 45%. And that allowed us to kill Osama bin Laden. Mm-hmm. If we had 95% of our supplies dependent going through Pakistan, that would have been a lot harder operation.
Right.
And a bunch of
that was in Russia's benefit too.
And it was in all of these things, in my view, mm-hmm. were all in Russia's benefit. That's mm-hmm. the nature of diplomacy. I've been speaking a lot about the book lately and people ask, well, why didn't you do more concessions towards Russia? And nobody does any favors for anybody. That's mm-hmm. that's a myth. Right. Even Macron doesn't do any favors for the United States or our closest allies. It's all we do things if they're in interest or what Obama used to call win-win outcomes.
Right.
And the other thing I hope is lasting, but I don't know if it is I think we proved that there is an alternative path to the confrontational one that I think Putin has set us down on. We didn't change our reset policy. He was the one that walked away. I think one of the chapters in my book is It Takes Two to Tango.
Right.
And no matter what we wanted to do to continue it, he had a different agenda. But at least I think we reminded people that there's an alternative path to the one we're in now.
Right. And it seems as though from the book that there's a very clear break in his behavior around 2011, 2012,
yes.
just as you were arriving as ambassador.
Yeah, I mean, two things. One, he decided to run for president again.
Right.
And when we started dealing with him, he has a very different worldview than Medvedev had, mm-hmm. zero sum. And number two, he thinks that we were out to get him. He thinks that we were funding opposition members against him, and he blamed us for the mobilization against him in 2011 and 2012, and he blamed me personally for that. And no amount of diplomacy and nice pieces of chocolate cake, you know, and very good meetings was going to get over that fundamental impasse that he thought we, the democratic states in the world, were out to put pressure on him.
Right, right. And of course, the accusation is this leads him in 2016 to meddle in the U.S. elections against Hillary Clinton, who was your boss at the State Department during those protests. So were you surprised by those reports that Russia may have, well, it looks as though our intelligence agencies have all agreed, and even the U.S. Senate Intelligence Committee has agreed that Russia meddled. Are you surprised by that at all?
Uh-huh. I was surprised. And I, you know, when that started to happen here, I was back here at Stanford, but, you know, I was in the media. I read a piece, a monthly column for The Washington Post, and when I started to write about it, I remember specifically August 2016, I wrote, I devoted my column to the Post to this, called Why Putin Wants Trump to Win and Maybe Even Be Helping Him.
Right.
And because the evidence, I think, was, you know, coming to the fore. And I got so much hate mail about that piece. One, just people couldn't believe it because it was so shocking. Now we're not as shocked, but then people were shocked. Even at the White House, I think they were shocked. And then two, the Trump supporters were angry at me. They were like, how dare you say that Putin is helping us? But I think it shows the evolution of Putin. So whatever cards Putin has in terms of power cards and pushing back against us, which most certainly is what he's trying to do. He sees himself in an ideological struggle against the illiberal decadent West, he being the conservative family values guy. And in the earlier parts of his career, he wouldn't have done that. But now, after two decades in power, he's willing to take really very risky actions like annexation in Ukraine and intervening in our election. And I think he's going to be that way for a long time to come.
Right. Yeah. And in the book, actually, you have a great quote from him in 2008 saying that Crimea is not a disputed territory. Russia has long recognized the borders of today's Ukraine. And then
his words, not mine.
Exactly. Yes. His words. Yeah. So I guess the last question, Mike, is there any prospect for better future U.S.-Russian relations while Putin is still president? And do you have any advice to your successors, that is the current senior director for Russia and Eurasia, Fiona Hill, in the Trump administration, and Mr. Trump's ambassador to Russia, John Huntsman?
Yeah. Well, I've talked to them a little bit. I would say a couple of things. One is, in the short run, which is to say when Putin is in power, I think tragically, and I really want to emphasize tragically, we need to have a strategy of pushback on his negative behavior in the international system. So to contain that, to deter it, that has to be a key component. Mm-hmm. And in the margins, when our interests overlap, not be afraid to cooperate with Putin and the Kremlin on very specific things. For instance, we need new arms control because Putin's announced he's got all kinds of new, very frightening weapons. We need to get back into a discussion about arms control.
Some of which he demonstrated in a video, of course, showing the missile hitting Florida, of all places, from Mar-a-Lago.
Well, those things are real. Mm-hmm. I've been studying those weapons for a long time as a government official, and they're destabilizing. So you need to do that. But you don't do it by calling him your buddy. You don't do it by checking your values at the door. You do it in this way that you part push and part engagement, a lot like the Cold War. I think my advice to them would be to read George Shultz's memoirs. Buy my book first. They don't have any time to read anymore. Everybody else should buy my book first and read it. But as a guide to how to deal with Putin's Russia, I think Shultz had a pretty good strategy for that. Mm-hmm. And hope for the long term. In the long term, I'm always optimistic about Russia, which is to say, you know, Russians helped to end the Cold War in 1990-91. We should remember that. Yeah. Democrats and Ukrainians fighting for to being part of the West, and Ukrainians and Georgians and Estonians too. Russians, I think, started the Cold Peace, and one in particular, Vladimir Putin. But if you accept my actor-centric argument, as you rightly pointed out, and I know it's controversial, that means that new actors can actually start a process of, you know, internal change in Russia and closer cooperation with us.
Well, I think Gorbachev and Yeltsin and Medvedev all demonstrate that that's
the
correct.
Possibility.
The possibility is there. So the book again is called From Cold War to Hot Peace, An American Ambassador in Putin's Russia. It is available on
everywhere.
Everywhere.
Even in Costco, I just found out today.
Oh, that's great. So you can buy it in bulk then.
Yes.
I'm Catherine Stoner, the Deputy Director of the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University. I've been talking to the director of the Institute, Michael McFaul, who's usually your host here on World Class from the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford. If you liked this episode, please review us on iTunes. It helps other people find the show. And be sure to subscribe to stay up to date on what's happening in the world and why.